Oh, hey there. I'm Guy Branum, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over all the pop culture we love to love. We meet to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining. Our journalist and novelist, Margaret Wappler.
Hey there, Guy.
Hey, Margaret. How you doing?
I'm doing pretty good.
That was a pretty great episode last week without me. I was really sad not to be part of the game.
We were sad to miss our White Panther.
You guys were doing fine. Plus, we got pop culture scholar and dyke about town, Karen Togson.
Hey, Guy. Hi, Rocketeers.
Hey, Karen. Like, really sad that I did not get to talk to you about Ugly Delicious or meet Tav, who seemed really cool.
Well, you'll get to meet him at some point, but apparently you were sitting next to some young twink reading a book on the airplane. I mean, according to your Twitters, you were having a perfectly fine time without us.
That's fair. That's fair. Our first official inclusion writer guest panelist, Chris Schleicher, here to raise the visibility of former figure skaters. He also happens to be a TV writer and pop culture savant. Chris Schleicher, thanks for being here.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello, Chris.
Happy to fill in over here.
Coming up on this week's show, we're going to be talking about the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences Awards of Merit, known to you as the Oscars. Plus, we'll each be sharing our latest jams. But first, let's find out what arts and entertainment news or events have got our attention this week. Chris Schleicher, what are you all about this week?
You know, I'm going to come in real high class on mine because I'm going to end with some much more fun thing for my jam. I watch all of these short films every year because I have like an
Show
Oscar
off.
Disease.
Show off.
And with MoviePass, it's like way easier. But there is a documentary short that won called Heaven is a Traffic Jam on the 405 that I absolutely love. And it's about this artist, Mindy Alper, who's based in L.A. and she has many sort of mental disorders and her struggles through her life with her mother. And it's animated through her drawings, parts of it, and interviews. And it's so gorgeous that I was like weeping in the theater and there was spontaneous applause.
Yeah.
Which is so nice in the category where usually you see a movie about Ebola and like the children of Agent Orange and a girl who was almost honor killed. Like that was, 1 year, all three of those were back to back and I nearly slit my wrist. I always struggle to get people to see these because I think it's the best thing about the Oscars is like they celebrate these small things too and give them time on the show. And so many of my friends are like, I'm really into documentaries right now. I just watched another thing about a serial killer on Netflix.
Yeah.
I'm like, this is on YouTube right now. You can watch it. Heaven is a Traffic Jam on the 405. It's 40 minutes long and it's beautiful. And I think it represents the best of what the Oscars have to offer, throwing new things into the spotlight when we've been seeing the same movies at every award show before.
It used to be that to watch like the shorts or the documentaries, you had to like live in a major city or something like that. And it is cool that like I was flipping through Netflix and like My Life as a Zucchini was there. And, you know, there's there are easier ways for everybody in all of America to get to watch this stuff.
And since they've been releasing them in theaters, I think they're a surprise success story. There was like a few $100,000 they made the first couple of years, and now they're in the millions of dollars they're making. People are interested in seeing these. You get to see five little films that were made by not super major people in the business, but they're very well made.
Margaret, what are you all about this week?
I'm all about season 3, Unreal. It's back. There is no other show that I probably root for harder because the first season was really magnificent. And, I mean, we should just say full disclosure that one of the creators, Sarah Gertrude Shapiro, is a friend of Pop Rocket. But all the same, I would be into the show no matter what. It hits all the buttons for me. But I do think the second season stumbled a little bit. It made some risky choices, and it didn't always pay off.
I didn't make it through.
Yeah.
And I love the first season so much.
I know. The first season is sterling, and then the second season, I think they just tried some things that didn't quite pay off. Like, some of the, like, racial themes that they tried to strike didn't quite gel together. But all the same, they're back with this third season, and they have switched up the formula a little bit. So the show is based on a Bachelor-like show, reality show, called Everlasting. And this time around, Everlasting has a female, a bachelorette, at the center of the game.
A sutress.
Yes, a sutress, exactly. And she's billed as a female Elon Musk type of person. and she is on there. I mean, this is one of my biggest questions about this new season is, like, why would this woman try to find love on this show?
Yeah.
And I'm sure we're going to see that play out and find more and more about that. Right now, and this is just having seen only the first episode, she seems to be, like, completely tilted toward business, has all this acumen in that area, but then is lost when it comes to actually connecting with men. So the show is back up to a lot of its usual tricks where we're seeing, like, Quinn being fiery and ratings, ratings, ratings. And then we're seeing Rachel, who just came back from a silent retreat kind of thing where she was working on radical
living
honesty.
Living in a yurt.
Yeah, living in a yurt, as you do when you're on break from
a
your reality
TV show.
A fancy
yurt, by the way.
I sort of coveted the
yurt, yes.
Yeah, that's the glamping thing that we all know of in California. So she's back, and she's practicing her radical honesty. There's certain people I wasn't as psyched to see come back. Like, of course, those two, I love them. But, like, Jeremy, I'm like, you know, just put Jeremy on ice. But that's cool. We'll see where that all goes.
Yeah, I mean, this was also going to be my all about this week. It's sort of this and half of another one. But I feel like we're going to be just stuck with Jeremy. I think that, you know,
they've invested
in the
too much
larger
at this
universe.
Point.
I'm not sure if it's
Bierko?
The no.
That, no, Chet. That's Chet.
That's
and I
Chet.
Enjoy
He's
Chet.
Great. But I do think that there's something about it being on Lifetime that facilitates a Jeremy-type character.
Yeah.
And it was
it still has to be dishy and soapy, and he's kind of like the main character working that framework right now, I feel like.
And the great thing last year was that Jeremy, in season two, was that Jeremy ended up being so schlumpy and having gained so much weight and being rather abject. So I think that it's kind of going to be interesting to see what it's like to get him full force.
He was at least handsome again. Yeah,
yeah,
I was encouraged
he's sort
by
of
that.
Handsome-ish again. I'm also really excited by the season and what it presents. And Caitlin Fitzgerald is fantastic. She was in Masters of Sex, and she was fantastic in that. And so right now, I think that especially from what I've seen around the discussions about the show, the creators have been talking a lot about leaning hard on feminism. It's kind of bread and butter, right? They were actually the two leads, Shiri Appleby and Constance Zimmer, and Shapiro and Stacey Rookeiser were on the Today Show with Megyn Kelly, which I kind of want to ask her what that felt. But they, you know, Megyn Kelly made a big deal out of the fact that you're feminists, right? And I think that is
Megyn Kelly still shocked by feminism.
Yes, exactly. But I think that that's what they're really sort of leaning hard on. And I have to say, season two is not as bad when you watch it as a binge.
Yeah.
Like, if you have to wait weekly, like, the kind of extremities and absurdities seem more inflated. I'm wondering if with season three, we'll have something more than the sense of a woman who's a little bit older, completely accomplished in her career, who just is too intimidating to men and masculine figures. But I'm super stoked about it. And the other sort of half of my all about this week is really just this kind of, I don't think it was on purpose, but the sort of rise of post-Me Too, like, feminist-centered programming, including the network effort at that, which is Good Girls, which is sort of, I like to think of it as kind of if Set It Off went to the suburbs, you know, insofar as if you have Christina Hendricks, Retta, and Mae Whitman as the three leads who are sort of unassuming moms in various ways who for reasons involving the precarity of their children, certain breakups, end up becoming bank robbers with, or not really bank robbers, but robbers with masks and guns and the whole thing.
What's interesting is that something so rooted in our current state of feminism, I think there's a movie from like 1982 with an almost identical premise. Uh-huh. And there is something so like early 80s about like, these ladies are going to get back at society. Like, it feels Mr. Mommy.
Like the 9-to-5 reboot that people have been talking about. I think one of the things about entering the era where we're supposedly making America great again, Trump's vision of that is all in the 1980s. So in many respects, the kind of social politics are as retrograde as 80s social politics were. And it is, I suppose, a ripe time to revisit how people confronted those particular circumstances at that time.
One thing that I really love about Good Girls is I feel like they grabbed three beloved performers that we do not know what to do with
yes.
and put them together. Because Retta is amazing, and like we just haven't made a show that centers somebody like Retta. Christina Hendricks, like she was on another period on Comedy Central that I wrote for,
which I was shocked. I never expected her to be on a show like that.
Right, but it was like she was like, I want to do comedy. Yeah. Like comedy is so much a part of what she did on Mad Men, and like Mae Whitman, who like. I mean, is it
Lorelai Gilmore's other daughter?
Well, and also like Mae Whitman as person who was not put in the Independence Day sequel because she's not pretty enough. Like this, like respected performer who has maintained a career for 15 years since she was the child star in Independence Day, it being like, well, you're not bombshell enough to be bombshell in this movie. And I just love that. I don't know if I'm saying that in a way that is mean. I don't mean it to be mean.
No,
I just mean
mean
it to
but
be
it's, but
reflective of what they did.
Mae Whitman has a very every woman quality to her, and she's not tiny in the way that, let's say, her co-star Sarah Ramos was in Parenthood. She can't do manic pixie dream girl type roles, even though she has those qualities about her. And I think that, I mean, I'm hoping that this will give her something to sink her teeth into. She already gets to, you know, flaunt an ill-advised tramp stamp that is a pivotal plot point in the pilot.
Well, is there a map to a prison on it that they have to use to escape?
I hope that's what it turns out to be. But
that is the sign of, like, being in the suburbs and meeting the wild girl of the suburbs,
yeah,
the tramp stamp.
Yes. Yeah, essentially, they in the first episode, they knock off a grocery store. In my mind, though, I sort of envisioned that it was a Michaels. Anyway.
I just hope they get enough time to, like, gel. Like, I feel like it's going to take those people a while to learn about each other as comic voices. Because, like, with the... I guess Mae Whitman was on Arrested Development and so has worked with, like big sort of comedy personalities. But, you know, stuff like that takes a while to figure out. All right. I will do my all about now. So, one of the reasons that I was gone for the many times that I've been gone is that my Hanukkah gift to my niece was to take her to New York and go see Too Much Theater.
Aww.
We saw a lot of your, the things you would expect. And then the last show we saw was the revival of Once on This Island, which less than a week after I had had a long conversation with Karen about whether or not Lea Salonga will eventually be president of the Philippines, I like got to the show and realized, what the fuck, Lea Salonga is in this? It had not even crossed my mind. It's such a good production. It is done at Circle in the Square, so it's in the round. Like, some people have to walk through sand to get to their seats. And Once on This Island is this, like, 1990 musical based on a, like, Harlem Renaissance-y short story that's a little bit Little Mermaid, a little bit Romeo and Juliet. But they have made some big, wonderful choices. And two of the biggest and most wonderful are reversing the genders of two of the gods. There are like four gods who are presiding over all of this. The Papa Gay, the god of death, they handed over to Merle Dandridge, and now it's Tamira Gray from
American Idol.
And so they took this role that was like a big dude role and kind of have been giving it to signature ladies. And then the role of Asaka, the like mother goddess, Alex Newell, who played, he is male identified, but he played a trans character on Glee, mm-hmm. and has really been like filling out a lot of female roles. He plays Asaka, and there's a lot of great in this show. Fucking Lea Salonga, isn't it?
Jeez,
and the
yeah.
fact that I am not playing for you her song should be testament to the fact that there is a lot of good shit going on. But here is a little bit of Mama Will Provide by Alex Newell. The extent to which he managed to fill up a space with his voice was overwhelming and transcendent, and it was so cool for my niece ever after having seen Dear Evan Hansen and Wicked, shows that she loves, after seeing Hello Dolly, which was essentially like a primer class in how you treat your divas, to take her to a show she knew nothing about and have her come away loving that one most. Pretty fucking great. Also, tickets are really cheap. You can get tickets for $60 if you're in town. And the cast album just came out, so love it.
I just keep picturing you and your niece wearing matching berets. Yes. True on any level. Don't disappoint me.
It is emotionally true.
Alex Newell was so good on Glee and came in late to that as the character Unique and has such great pop songs. I love Collect My Love is one of my favorite songs.
Yeah.
So I'm glad that he's getting something to shine in.
Well, it was also an interesting moment afterwards saying to my niece, like, who, like, just through Tumblr and stuff is way more aware of trans issues than I am, but sort of saying, like, him, and she's like, that was not a man. And I was like, yes, it was. And then sort of, like, talking about what the gender changes meant for the play and stuff. It was also they cook food on stage while the play is going, so that there
it's
are
not
like
just dry eyes.
So there are food smells. No, it was great. You're listening to Pop Rocket. We're gonna be right back to talk about all things Oscars after this.
Hi there, I'm film critic April Wolf and host of the Maximum Fun podcast, Switchblade Sisters. Do you love genre films? Do you love female filmmakers? Do you love discussions on craft? If your answer is yes, you'll love Switchblade Sisters. Every episode, I invite one female filmmaker on, and we talk in depth about their fave genre film and how it influenced their own work. So we're talking horror, action, sci-fi, fantasy, bizarro, and exploitation cinema. Mothers, lock up your sons, because the Switchblade Sisters are coming for you. Available at MaximumFun.org or wherever you find your podcasts.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are
Margaret Wappler,
Karen Tongson,
Chris Schleicher.
Sunday was film's biggest night, as the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences so frequently likes to remind us. Oscar turned 90, and we have to ask, is this nonagenarian still lucid? Does he get out of the house enough? Is he forgetting to take his meds? So first, let's just begin with, how did everybody consume the Academy Awards this year? Chris?
I was at a big party of mostly gay people, per usual, with weirdly like two televisions facing each other with like couches facing each other. So we're like watching over people's heads and like as if it were some sort of face-off, which was thrilling. and we had like ballots filled out. And
how did you do?
As I posted on Twitter, I had a wine-soaked ballot that had 21 out of 24, which is pretty good for me.
Yes.
My record is 23, which I will never surpass in my life again.
Did you win?
No, I had a friend who got 22.
What?
Was it someone I know?
It was Jordan Nardino.
Oh, okay. Margaret.
You know how we're supposed to be having a love affair with movies when we watch the Oscars?
Yeah.
I felt like my love affair was with a bottle of wine and a dear friend that came over and we caught up. And it was such a dry telecast this year that I had a hard time like really centering into it. So, yeah, I feel like as far as the Oscars go and my watching of them, it was a light turnout for me.
Karen, what about you?
Well, I had just returned from an afternoon boat from Catalina Island and made my way over to Tavanyongo's downtown, where there were also many gays and some good friends and a lovely cat. And we filled ballots out sort of haphazardly last minute. There was one TV. Everybody looked kind of orange. And frankly, I tend to live tweet these award shows. Uh-huh. So I just don't have the capacity to hold what's happening in front of me and also be on my tweeting machine. So I feel like there's a lot that passed me by. But I did like the weird Swarovski cave.
Yes, the orgasmatron. Thing.
The orgasmatron, yeah. Exactly, as Jane Fonda referred to it. So I did enjoy that, but it did feel very sedate, and it all felt very safe watching the telecast itself. I also felt safe watching it. Before we continue, though, I do need to announce the official Rocketeer Oscar pool winner from our Facebook group, and Burke Crowhey, or is it Croha, in St. Louis, narrowly defeated our defending champion, Chris Maurer, who reminded me to post the ballot. Burke had the score of 20 out of 24, so just one notch below Chris. Chris Schleicher here, and we had very close number two and three. So anyway, congratulations, Burke. You deserve your shout out.
That's very impressive.
Can I ask a question about Oscar ballots? Like, what criteria are you using to make your decisions? Because I feel like, are you just supposed to get into the mind of like a 75-year-old white male director type, or like what is it?
So the first thing to do is completely throw out the window what you want to win, because that will guide you like so far down the wrong path. But we have so many precursor awards now. We have the Golden Globes and the Guild Awards, the Producers Guild, the Directors Guild, the Writers Guild. So consensus is start to form throughout the season. The four acting races, we're pretty locked in. We've seen Frances McDormand, Sam Rockwell, Gary Oldman give so many speeches
at
this point.
The Actors Branch is such a huge part of the Academy that like watching the SAG Awards is most of what you need to know.
And there's a whole industry around predicting the Oscars. At like goldderby.com, they have the odds up. And my dirty little secret for always predicting the Oscars is put in the front runner in every single category and change like three or four where you smell like blood in the water. Like, this doesn't seem right. I don't think they'll go for this. Yeah.
Okay.
I love a last minute pivot. I love when you like feel like the heat leave from behind someone.
I mean, I usually swing to the odds on favorites. But this time around, for some reason, I was utterly convinced that Beauty and the Beast would snag, you know, set design and costumes.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because there was so much stuff in the trade press throughout the year about how much painstaking detail they invested in that production. But of course, I was like, oh yeah, they did that with Shape of Water too.
Production
design.
There was something just so like accessible and also like fancy about Phantom Thread and Shape of Water. Okay, I have to express how I watch the Academy Awards just because it leads me to a pet peeve and a light rant, which is like 4 or 5 years ago, I went to an Oscar party at one of my dear friend's homes, and then he announced to everyone that we would be watching it on a 1 hour delay.
No.
Oh, I remember you talking about this. That's so wrong.
It angered me so much that since then I have essentially sequestered myself and watched them alone so no one will get in the way of my experience of the Academy Awards. So I stayed in Washington, D.C. I was coming home on Monday anyway, I just stayed in a hotel room. Like, the people from Pop Culture Happy Hour were like, you should come watch with us. And I was like, no, I do not want anyone getting in the way of me seeing award shows.
I have a friend once who went over to watch either the Emmys or the Grammys and wants to pause it for like 20 minutes while he went to pick up pizza. And we've never forgiven him for it because he made us go through with it.
You can't do that.
We're all live tweeting it, so I'm going to be irrelevant.
Yeah. Also, pizza's deliver. What is he doing?
I do not know.
So, I mean, you made the point you should just select the front runners. Karen made the point that she had a couple of upsets she was hoping for. It was a pretty predictable Academy Awards. Was there anything that was surprising or even a high moment to you?
I was very worried that they would shut out Get Out altogether. Uh-huh. So Jordan winning, I thought Martin McDonagh might pull that off. The Jordan one was a big deal, I thought. And the first African-American to ever win original screenplay.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, and it was also just like, best original screenplay is so frequently like a prize, and there were so many nominees that would have, I mean, if Emily and Kumail had won, if Greta Gerwig had won, it would have been wonderful, and it really did feel like the only glowing moment in the evening.
He did win the WGA award,
though.
So that was the one mistake that I made, is that I was like, you know, I think they'll give this will be the bone they throw to get Greta Gerwig into Lady Bird. And then by the end of the night, I was like, I should have checked who won the WGA Awards.
Right.
You know, but it is well-deserved. It's tremendous. Once that happened, though, I knew that I sort of was hoping that Get Out would be the spoiler best picture.
Yeah.
But I think that once that went down, that kind of locked in the predictability of the rest of the evening, I think.
Although it was a rare thing stats-wise that usually screenplay and picture line up, because there's two screenplay awards.
Yes.
And The Artist was the last one to not win screenplay and win best picture, which made sense because no talking. but it's been a while. Yeah.
And like ever since we moved to 10 nominees for Best Picture, there has been a weird game of spoiler Best Picture happening. A lot, it's been more the rule that director and picture don't go together than do. And so I had some hope that like something interesting might happen with that. Like after Greta Gerwig lost Best Screenplay, I was like, will director be the bone? And the answer was no bones. No bones
way
for Sacramento. Yeah.
I almost feel like Lady Bird suffered from from the problem of, like, it's a movie about women and particularly a mother-daughter relationship that isn't rendered in, you know, complete histrionics or, like, something insane happening. Yeah. Like, it's a very, like, tender, poignant, YA-esque kind of story. And I think that in some ways hurt its chances because Hollywood likes to see nostalgia, for one thing, uh-huh. for itself, which I think is the Shape of Water factor.
Yeah.
And then also, like, they want something that is just more forcefully male a lot of times.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I also think there was something to her getting nominated that made a lot of people feel like, oh, that's good enough. That's good enough, honey.
There's also a lot of coded language frequently. They'll say a woman's movie, like, isn't important.
Yeah.
In a way,
yeah.
like a boy's coming of age. Of course, that's so essential. Like, but a woman is, oh, well, it's nice, a little movie.
He
it's
didn't not... throw his football with his dad, and then he did throw his football yeah. with his dad. We all understand that.
But I right. do think that Lady Bird suffered from some tremendous backlash, like on the kind yeah. of second in the second half of awards season. First, there were the sort of call-out pieces about its similarity to Real Women Have Curves.
Which
is weird. It's also like they're coming-of-age stories. They are yeah. all kind of structurally similar. The other is that I think that because so many people enjoyed it when it first came out and because of that super through-the-roof Rotten Tomatoes score and a lot of the critical praise, a lot of people went into it who came in late to it with more, I don't know, critical lenses, I would say.
I'm going to take a very controversial position. Mm-hmm. Traditionally, if you've got a semi-meaty 60 to 70% of the movie role for a woman, you can take that from Best Actress, put it down in Best Supporting Actress, and Viola Davis and Fences, you've got yourself an Academy Award. And here you had our two frontrunners for Best Supporting Actress were what Kate Berlant described as an SNL character from Alice and Janney, mm-hmm. and Laurie Metcalf in an extremely meaty, complex, and nuanced role. And I'm going to say that I'm going to put out there the possibility that if they had put Laurie Metcalf in Best Actress and it had been a sort of like network or terms of endearment sort mm-hmm. of two lead actor story that we could have gotten excited about. Will Laurie Metcalf shut out Saoirse Ronan? Will Saoirse Ronan shut out Laurie Metcalf? That it could have been something we got more excited about and was more of like a splashy story.
Ooh, it's dangerous, though. Mary Tyler Moore tried that in Ordinary People, yeah. and then Sissy Spacek, coal miners daughtered her way all over.
Somebody else tweeted, like, it's weird to be mad about Alice and Janney having an Oscar, and I just feel so deeply that way.
I'm mad about it, even though I like her, but I didn't want her to win. I wanted Laurie Metcalf to win. I still feel like that role is problematic. It makes me...
It's cartoonish.
Yeah, it's cartoonish about an abusive mom. It just feels kind of gross.
I also think Allison Janney's momentum picking up the Supporting Actress Awards also derailed Lady Bird quite a bit. Uh-huh. You know, because if Laurie Metcalf had picked up maybe one of the Supporting Actress Awards along the way, then Lady Bird would have still been a major contender.
But it told such an interesting story because Critics Awards, Laurie Metcalf was everywhere.
Yes.
But once you got to a point where this industry was voting, they were all voting for C.J. Craig. And who doesn't want to vote for C.J. Craig?
I think also a lot of these are still old white men voting and aren't comfortable with a nuanced mother. It's either they love their mommy and she's a saint, or they hate their mommy and she's an evil devil, and they'll vote for those two moms.
Yep.
But this in-between where, like, mom has feelings she can't express and sometimes feels inadequate and sometimes she's mean but has reasons, that's, like, over their head or something.
Yeah. I still have to just cling to the fact that a movie about not wanting to go to UC Davis was nominated for Best Picture and take that as a win.
They have such a great agriculture program.
On the subject of taking things as wins, I think we all thought it was entirely possible that Three Billboards Outside of Ebbing, Missouri was going to be taking home the big awards. And just, like, keeping the burn located to Best Actress and Best Supporting Actor, to me, felt like a bit of a victory.
Also that Frances gave us the memorable speech of the night made me feel like sort of forgive.
Well, and also Frances McDormand should have two Academy Awards. Mm-hmm. Did either of you see Three Billboards?
Yes.
You love it, Margaret? Was it a film for you?
No, it wasn't. that movie, I think, It thinks it's very smart, yeah. And I don't think it's that smart.
No.
And that's the biggest problem with it, is that I felt like constantly it was sort of congratulating itself and patting itself on the back, and there's a smugness to the storytelling, and I just don't think everything lined up there.
Yeah.
And I would blame that on the screenplay 100%. Like, I don't think it's anything about the actors' performances. I think the actors, like, saved it, in fact. Although, I do feel like Frances McDormand, I mean, I'm glad she won because she did give us such a momentous speech, but that, to me, was a role she could do in her sleep. And yeah. It's just not that exciting. Like, I want to see her at this point, like, do something that I haven't seen her do before, besides played, like, the hard-boiled, all-suffering kind of woman. I was glad to not see that movie get all that much.
I think the screenplay is a fun guessing game from a British person of what maybe American racial relations are like.
Yes. And the biggest problem, too, is like, we're going to talk about racial relations, but there are no people of color playing any kind of prominent role in
this
movie.
There's a second employee in the gift shop in Ebbing, Missouri, which is apparently a profitable venture.
Yes. And I remember her hair. That's what I remember about her. She had lovely hair.
Like, she's still in the movie North Country, but works in a gift shop. Like, I thought from the commercial she had a factory job.
Are you annoyed or fine with Sam Rockwell winning Best Supporting Actor? And also, how did Michael Stuhlbarg not end up getting nominated for Best Supporting Actor? The fucking Richard Jenkins from Shape of Water was nominated, but not Stuhlbarg with the thing we all said, well, that's an Oscar scene.
Yeah, it totally was an Oscar scene. But I do think Jenkins all throughout was pretty much the translator for Sally Hawkins.
Yeah.
And that's why it got the nomination.
Yeah, even her clip, her Best Actress clip, is essentially Richard Jenkins talking, right? And emoting for her.
Which isn't to say, I mean, I think her acting was incredible, but, you know, I was okay with Sam Rockwell winning, even though I didn't like the movie all that much, but I like him, and I think he's a great actor, and I think he's been kicking around for a long time, so I just imagined that he was winning for Moon, which is one of my favorite movies.
That's fair, and there was that real gigantic moment when Frances McDormand won, and there's always that moment when somebody's doing something shticky, when you're like, wait, is this going to pay off? It was lovely.
Yeah, I think with the Stuhlbarg issue is they thought Armie Hammer was really going to catch fire from it and didn't, and it was a little too late for them to tack fully Stuhlbarg.
Yeah.
And he had so many pots in the fire. He was in three of the nominated films this year. That
made me think he was more likely to get nominated in that very, like, Timothy Chalamet or Jessica Chastain in that year when she was even in Coriolanus. Yeah. Like,
Yeah, I do think that that was part of what undid Michael Stuhlbarg's chances, is that he was just in so many different things. At the same time, I don't know that everybody sort of coalesced around a single role for him that would be nominated, right? I mean, you know, not that the Post would have picked up a nomination for him or anything.
For that guy who owns the New York Times.
For Best Supporting Actor, everybody loves a rogue.
Yeah.
I think that's sort of the rogues.
That's a great point.
That's true.
You have your Jack Palances, you have your, you know, like these big personalities. And Sam Rockwell, I guess, sort of fulfilled that role. But
well, there's that thing of like wanting people to win because you know they're going to give you an interesting speech. And, like, I mean, Allison Janney and Sam Rockwell are definitely like, well, that's going to be entertaining. And Allison Janney fucking provide it. Like, going up and saying, I did this all on my own. That's
and crediting the bird, thanking the bird, which I think is key.
Everyone thought they had a surefire winner with mentioning the jet ski in their speech. Like, it was cute the first time someone's like, I guess I'm not getting the jet ski.
Yeah.
But, like, number six is like, you have to abandon that joke. It was probably very funny when you thought of it.
I thought it was a beautiful shtick, though. I thought it was a beautiful...
I liked it, too.
Yeah.
I thought it was a very funny joke, but I don't like that the Oscars, like, hates itself and immediately is apologizing for, like, taking up any of your time.
Well, there was fucking Gary Oldman going on and on and on about his fucking process. It's like, no one cared. Like, that was just such a, like, slog. It was the one time in the acting awards that I was maybe thinking we would have a shift, and it might have crossed somebody's mind that an interesting role was a good thing.
That one hurt. Like, Frances McDormand, fine, totally good with it. But, like, I don't know. Gary Oldman, I didn't feel it on that. And I kept feeling like, this is where I want Daniel Kaluuya to pull through. Or Kaluuya. Yeah. Because I feel like the more I think about it, the more his performance, like, really held that movie together in really key ways. I feel like he's too much of a young Turk right now. Yeah. Maybe he'll get his time later.
I do think that Frances's speech and the big inclusion writer statement that was made there gave us a sense of how much more the Oscars are like becoming insidery and kind of more industry, like a more, I don't know, self-focused on the kind of conversations happening in the industry and the business, as much as they are about like the montages reminding us of like 90 years of cinema. We're supposed to capture those kind of sentimental affective moments, but really, I think that, you know, Frances McDormand's speech laid bare for us how much and how really intensely the Oscars are about the business.
Well, instead of being one of those years where the big political issue is something sort of like external, like whether you know, AIDS or war or whatever, this was, I mean, this is a year
where the movie business was in crisis.
But also one of the big political stories this year was a labor issue that like sort of got played out in entertainment. Mm-hmm. My favorite moment from the Frances McDormand Everybody Standing Up was a couple of moments later, Kumail Nanjiani posts a photo of from below of Emily V. Gordon, his wife and co-writer for The Big Sick, and just this moment of like him being like taking the moment to be proud and recognize her, you know, because he's like a face and everything. It was fucking beautiful.
I love that.
It really was like a lovely moment of being able to say, you know, in an award show that wasn't celebrating women's stories particularly, had fewer female winners than any Academy Award since like 2012 or something like that, to say that's at least our purpose, you know, one of our purposes going forward.
I think in some ways the Oscars, they usually benefit from being like the final crowning ceremony of the season.
Yeah.
But in this case, I feel like its wins were taken out of its sails by Golden Globes and all the women wearing black.
Yeah.
And like some of the drama of the moment has already been sucked out of the room by the time the Oscars come around. But I did feel like I know we can't be in like funeral mode forever and wear black dresses to everything, but I kind of wondered like why didn't they continue that part of the protest like through the season? Like wouldn't that have had a little more like stamina and a little more effect? But I get it. I love royal blue and peacock yellow and all that too.
How do you guys think Kimmel did?
You know, I think he does a good job in that, like, he kind of disappears and I forget that he was even there, which most of the time we were, like, going in the next day about how much we hated the person. And if you, like, acquit yourself sort of okay, that's, like, a win in my Oscar book.
Yeah.
Like, where someone like Neil Patrick Harris, where you couldn't forget he was there and he was reminding us he's doing a failing bit with Octavia Spencer in a suitcase. like, just being able to recede and let the show is the star. It's the 90th anniversary, which they didn't play much with that. Versus like the 75th, where it was a very, let's look at Oscar's past.
Was that when we had all the winners on stage?
That was when Olivia de Havilland announced like 40 winners' names in a row who were all sitting with each other. Yeah.
It was interesting to see Kimmel like so aware of what not to do that he really was like, at least he didn't trip over himself in that monologue. At least he didn't make a joke that we the next day were saying like,
well, he checklisted his way through the whole process. It was
a solid beat.
It was
you
very
know?
Same. It was like, you know, here, I've hit the marks. I've made a Trump joke. I made a Pence joke. I've mentioned Me Too. You know, it's sort of like, I'm going to do all these things in the most innocuous way possible and then just get out of here.
He did double down on my least favorite bit of last year, which is who wants to touch an unwashed commoner? Which
God,
of you will come with me to see the simple folk watching this movie?
Well, I mean,
hot dog gun.
The tropes
hot dog
I hate
cannon.
Are giving food to people because they are hungry because it took too long. And who wants to touch a real person?
It reminds me of those... Our old showrunner, Matt Warburton, used to remind us, like, don't make jokes about, like, Florida being bad because most people think of Florida as the best place they could ever go. So when you're making jokes about, like, oh, everyone's, like, hates being at the Oscars this long and they're dressed and they're hungry, being like, they would kill to be there.
Yeah.
Everyone would love to be there.
It was
insidery.
I do love that when he says, like, come along, everyone, the people they have clearly already scripted to come, and Lin-Manuel Miranda.
I was terrified that for some of the lesser-known actors, they would just not be recognized.
Yeah.
Same.
Like, Margot Robbie, I guess she's in Suicide Squad. Like, Armie Hammer, are they going to recognize?
Yeah, I was like, who
Emily
are they
going to?
Yeah. How are they going to figure out who Armie Hammer is?
Yeah.
I was like, how many of them are going to know who Guillermo del Toro is? Yeah.
It's going to be like this handsome Ken doll shot a hot dog at me. I guess I'm cool with that.
Was that Aaron Eckhart?
Yeah.
Oh, poor Aaron Eckhart.
Where is he?
Margaret was talking about fashion. What were the good fashion stories?
Rita Moreno.
Oh, yes.
Loved it.
Yeah.
I loved Nicole Kidman wearing what I describe as a Georgia O'Keeffe sculpture.
Uh-huh.
Just the giant blue sculpture.
I liked it, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
People were ripping on
bow
it.
On
really
her vagina.
A giant vaginal bow.
And it was also nice after, like, Black Panther had a fucking fashion tour that, like, Chadwick Boseman showed up in, like, a bunch of people showed up in, like, cooler, interesting tuxedos, which is not something guys do normally. And when Tiffany Haddish showed up, I was like, that is statement-y. That is really interesting. And then only later discovered it was, like, traditional Eritrean outfit in tribute to her dad, which was, it was kind of cool that it was also kind of on trend.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Wow.
Lupita's
Bingo.
Dress was really fabulous as well.
Yeah, that's the kind of dress that, like, could look like an ice skating uniform on the wrong person, but she totally pulled it off.
Hey, ice skating outfits are beautiful. Speaking of which, Adam Rippon was there.
Yes.
Wearing harnesses as part of his tuxedo.
And I, like, some gay guys on my Twitter feed were like, an unfitted tarnus from Moschino. I mean, what the fuck? But I just loved that, A, oh, fuck, my phone just went off. I'm a bad host.
One of those gays is, like, trying to catch me. Don't call me out.
Like, I loved that Adam Rippon came and was just undeniably gay, did something that was so sexual and, like, present. It, like, there were things about that outfit that were actively bad. Someone his height should not be wearing tails and no socks. It made him look 2 feet tall. But the fact that he showed up to be, like, unapologetic about who he was thrilled me.
Also kind of understanding why you're there. Like, you were brought in a Winter Olympic year. You probably won't be invited again. Like, give us something fun on the red carpet. Men's fashion is so boring as is. There was a horrible British article, though, that said he was wearing a harness because it was a reference to 50 Shades. I was like, oh, no, honey. You've never heard of gay sex.
I'm glad that we're leaving a world where who has the best fitted black Tom Ford tuxedo is the only thing we can talk about for men's fashion.
I love Daniel Kaluuya's. I keep wanting to say Kahlua because I apparently want that in my coffee. But his tux I thought was really sharp.
Yeah. It's like a rust color, auburn shaded.
It looked great with
dinner jacket.
These people have to wear outfits that look good in the sun on the red carpet and under the lighting in there. I always panic for that.
Right. I mean, well, that whole thing of you never know entirely what color it's going to look like on television, which is why when you have somebody like Jennifer Garner, who we are at a point where we don't know what we're going to do with Jennifer Garner. And also, I'm on record as hating Jennifer Garner. But
there's a lot of haters in this crew. I mean, hates her.
The fact that she showed up with an outfit that was essentially an argument for her inclusion, her continued inclusion in Hollywood, kind of made me happy.
And did she plan a meme in advance? Was she like, I'm going to look troubled in the middle of this collapse so I can get a little mileage out of
her,
this?
Her winter was planning that all along, was strategizing that. I mean, I do, like, you mentioned Tiffany Haddish. We do, like, of course, she did also show up in the same dress that she's been wearing on the red carpets everywhere. So that was, like, one of the other things that was sort of memorable about, like, you know, a kind of repeat thing that was memorable about, like, her appearance on the Oscars. And, of course, her and Maya Rudolph, who basically stole the show, and everybody was immediately, like, talking about having them host next year, although I'm not sure that would happen.
I mean, it would be so amazing. It is, when people show up and pull off, like, reading prompter and doing their bit, like, the two of them, it's just like, what is everyone else's problem that they don't get to that place? They were so funny. When fucking Sandy Bullock showed up and was given a kind of sweaty bit and pulled it off so perfectly, it's like, fuck you to everyone else who came in awkwardly red.
There was also something joyous about Eva Marie Saint trying to land, like, 3 jokes that didn't hit.
Director Fred Hitchcock took me to Berghoff Goodman, where together we chose some of the beautiful wardrobe. And my favorite was always the black dress with the red roses. Do you remember that, ladies?
I mean, she's 93. Yeah. She can do whatever the fuck she wants.
I guess I'm older than Oscar.
When they introduced Lupita Nyong'o and Kumail Nanjiani, I was like, thank God, we have finally reached the point in Hollywood where we don't feel the obligation to make a joke about how no one can pronounce their name. Mm-hmm. And then they had to deliver a joke about how no one can pronounce their name.
Good evening. We are the two actors you keep hearing about, but whose names you have trouble pronouncing.
Actually, I have to come clean. Kumail Nanjiani is my stage name. My actual given Pakistani name is Chris Pine.
It was just, guys, let's think about it. Like, does that, like, why do we keep having to, like, condition their celebrity? Like, we they're famous, but weird.
Kumail had one of the moments of the show for me in that montage about diversity and inclusion where he spoke something so eloquently that, yes, I've been trying to say forever, which I have up on my phone. Some of my favorite movies are movies by straight white dudes about straight white dudes. Now straight white dudes can watch movies starring me, and you relate to that. It's not that hard. I've done it my whole life. Mm-hmm. Well, that skill set that women, gay men, minorities, we don't get a million movies about us. Mm-hmm. We have no choice but to watch movies about people who aren't us and build the skill of relating to someone who's not you. And that straight white men, like, sometimes, like, maybe they just haven't built this skill yet because they can go through a whole year with watching movies where they're the protagonist.
Yeah.
Well, and so frequently the conversation about diversity is negativity and everyone wants to classify it as, like, hateration. But, like, having people like Jordan Peele and Kumail Nanjiani who fucking love movies and are there to, like, celebrate movies. And, you know, the fact that, I mean, Get Out is such a love letter to the Stepford Wives.
Yes, yes.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, that's the aspect. I can't believe that when you were talking earlier, Margaret, about how Hollywood loves to pat itself on the back, especially, you know, rewarding self-referentiality for Best Picture, that it just, they couldn't wrap their minds around the fact that that's what Get Out was doing. It was very much participating in the same kind of homage to genre film.
I guess totally he's coming to dinner even.
Yeah. I totally agree. I mean, I think when you see what was the kind of quote we had on the script from like a female Academy voter, anonymous, and she talks about how she didn't really like Get Out because she says it played the race card.
And it's a good B movie.
Yeah, and I feel like that's what I guess dented its chances of winning, is that it sailed over people's heads.
Well, and Darkest Hour played the war card.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what it was about.
Exactly. Like, why is it playing a card to simply be
about
something?
The Dan Churchill card.
Yes.
Prosthesis card.
For those of you who aren't aware, The Hollywood Reporter ran this article like a week before the Academy Awards where they talked to an anonymous Academy voter who basically expressed every middle brow bad sentiment you could want. Call Me By Your Name is creepy because it's an older guy and a younger guy, and it, like, Get Out was playing the race card. It was the worst.
It really, my stomach sank, and especially when I saw that it was a woman, even more was like, what?
I didn't read the whole thing. I just read clips of it, but I always imagined it was just a dude. I imagined a dude in like his late 50s.
That's why President Trump won.
Yeah, exactly. Sob.
Another sadness of the evening was watching the E! Coverage. Did anyone watch Red Carpet on E!?
I have some of it, yes. I was very aware of who was going to talk to Ryan Seacrest or not.
It was so weird because, like, everyone else who was in the entire thing were all women and one gay guy, Brad Goreski, and then, like, the weird thing of, like, two women ended up talking to Ryan Seacrest because, of course, there have been accusations about him sexually harassing a colleague that E! Has decided that they are going to ignore, not so long after Kat Sadler had to leave because they weren't paying her as much as her.
Well, they investigated means, and decided
and came to
clear
the conclusion
him.
That, yeah, he's cleared.
But it was such an interesting thing to be like, their fear of going off the reservation to remove him from their coverage, what would happen to it. But what ended up happening was an even starker reminder of the irrelevance of E.
And did you see that Taraji P. Henson moment that went a little viral?
Why don't you tell everybody about it?
She talked to Ryan, but gave him a very, like, ominous, The universe has a way of protecting the good people.
And grabs his chin. Yeah. Like, grabs his chin in, like, the most wonderful, somebody tweeted it with, did Taraji just put a curse on him?
Yes. And the answer is yes.
It was magnificent.
And also the tone deafness of giving Kobe Bryant an Oscar. For best animated short.
As someone who saw the shorts, like, there's an argument, but a very bad argument to be like, horrible person, if they made the best thing, we should award to them. It is the worst thing I've ever seen nominated in any category for anything. It's like a 5-minute, like, bad, like, Reebok commercial. Like, I used to throw rolled up socks into a hoop, and then I made the NBA as a champion, but now I'm retired. If it was like a 7th grade writing project, I would give it a C.
And there were several other animated shorts that were based on poetry as well, right? So you could have gone with Roald Dahl, like,
yes,
poem,
Revolting
right?
Rhymes. There was a beautiful thing about, like, a dead dad who taught someone how to pack a bag and a garden party with these frogs that was animated well. Like, there were 4 that were clearly better, and we gave it to someone accused of rape who made the worst thing.
In the age of Me Too.
On that note, just to go back to Gary Oldman for a moment, a lot of stuff about him beating his wife and all of that. But on top of it, just not only was it an opportunity for Best Actor to go to somebody else, but it was also an opportunity for Best Actor to stop its tradition of, for so long, Best Actress was an ingenue in her first film or one of her first films, and having an exciting moment for her where Best Actor has always gone to a man for his career. And the fact that we had Timothy Chalamet there and Daniel Kaluuya and so many people full of promise, literally looking at Timothy Chalamet and thinking, what shitty The Revenant am I going to have to sit through for him to get his Oscar? What turgid fucking man movie am I going to have to watch?
Oh, I don't want him to have to work out. I want him, like, all scrawny and New York cool.
He's made of noodles.
Well, it's the second year in a row that they gave Best Actor to a dubious person.
What was last year?
Casey Affleck.
Oh, my God.
And Brie Larson.
So
had
they
to give
really
it to
just doubled down.
Yeah.
You know, this time around.
Well, I mean, I also the fact that, like, we had to get not former winners to present Best Actor and Best Actress because
to work around Casey Affleck.
What to you was, like, the takeaway? What gives you hope for this industry? I will say, like, the fact that even though she did not get a nomination, Tiffany Haddish was there and proving herself at every moment. It's sad that she has to do that while Timothy Chalamet can just roll in and say, I dated Madonna's daughter, and everyone gives him the keys to the kingdom. But the fact that Tiffany Haddish is fucking up for the fight thrills me. Karen?
Daniela Vega on stage. And the film from Chile, A Fantastic Woman, winning the Best Foreign Language Oscar.
Margaret,
I mean, same basic idea as Karen, that, you know, a few years ago, the Academy was outed as being, you know, 98% white male or whatever it was. And there have been some shifting demographics in that voting block where they've allowed in younger people and people of color and women and blah, blah, blah. And I do think we're seeing the fruits of that through these nominations like Greta Gerwig and Get Out. I mean, the fact that Get Out was nominated for as many things as it was, I think is totally implausible, even like 2-3 years ago.
That's very true.
And so I just think about those aspects of the nominations, and I take hope from that, as well as like the cool actors that are around, like Timothy Chalamet and like these other people that's like, they're going to do great work.
My thing that was I found very encouraging about this Oscars was seeing queer people thank their husbands and wives and feeling like not surprised or shocked by it anymore. It felt like something natural where, like, my ears always perked up. And in Coco, 2 people thanked their partners in a beautiful way. And we got to see James Ivory thank Ismael Merchant in a very touching way that was, like, so, like, not emotional for him, but to see that happen on the stage was really big.
James Ivory and Ismael Merchant were partners, but also made all of the classic Merchant Ivory movies together. And the fact that he said, my 2 partners, and he thanked Ruth Pryor Jabala and his, like, life partner in the same breath was with a fucking, like, line drawing of Timothy Chalamet looking his most pensive and beautiful on his chest. It was a wonderful moment. And Chris of course, brought up, for me, the most needling truth of these Academy Awards, which is that the gay co-director of Coco is from Yuba City, which means, like...
Sacramento's back, baby!
I can whine all I like about being the only gay in the village, but it's just not true.
I had a similar Oscar experience where I found out that in my high school, Captain Phillips went there, so... I'm never going to beat that Oscar history.
That is wonderful. And finally, is the Academy Awards defending its role as the signature awards show? Margaret made a hard argument for the Golden Globes. I would say the Independent Spirit Awards.
Spirit Awards have been inching up every year.
Yeah. Karen, what to you was, your favorite of the...
Because I'm still fundamentally an old, I think that I enjoy the Globes, although I think of the Oscars as still the kind of standard bearer bestowing people with, legitimacy in really profound ways. Whereas, the Globes still do feel like a bit of a run-up. I have to say that the Independent Spirit Awards, though, because of the choices it makes, is really telling us about the potentiality or the kind of potential, the futures that are available to Hollywood, to filmmaking, I don't know. I mean, I hope that more Academy voters take seriously the things that are happening at the Spirit Awards.
One of the reasons why I love the Oscars and it's my favorite and why it runs long is it's the one that takes the time to put the makeup and hairstylist person on stage, mm-hmm. the sound editor on stage, documentarians on stage. At the Globes, we don't get that because we're squeezing in TV too. So that it is an insider award and is Hollywood celebrating all the way down the crew list, I think is beautiful. And I think sometimes we don't zoom out enough to think how much it has changed recently. Like, pretty weird movies win. Like, I heard people calling The Shape of Water safe, which I'm like, a woman masturbates on film in the first minute of it. And it's a weird story about immigration and having sex with a creature.
Interspecies desire.
Birdman one was a strange pick. Moonlight we never thought could have won. Ever since they opened up the about to between 5 and 10, and I think since 2009 we've seen a much wider type of movie being celebrated versus the 2000s and 90s when it was a lot of this, like Darkest Hour was the type of thing that won and was nominated and everything.
Or Dunkirk.
Yes.
Having an Academy Awards that was legitimately a cat's game. That, like, at the end of it, they're doing stories about how Shape of Water with four wins, like, sweeps. It's like, if Lady Bird had managed to get something, I think I would feel a lot better about this. There was one, like, 96, I think, where it really was, like, everything that should have gotten an award got an award, except for Secrets and Lies. And I like an Academy Awards like that. This is Pop Rocket. We're going to be right back with our jams right after this.
Going into a Bullseye interview, I know it's somebody who does amazing work, but it's an actual conversation. I don't know where it's headed.
Hey, this is the straight talk that you're going to get on this show.
Does that make sense? I feel like I'm in therapy.
I think I got more out of you than the therapist I went to twice.
Bullseye. Creators you know, creators you need to know. Find it at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get podcasts.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Scott Branham. With me in the studio are...
Margaret Wappler.
Karen Tongson.
Chris Schleicher.
Every week on the show, we ask the question, what's your current jam? So I'm going to turn to my friend Karen Tongson and ask her, Karen, what is your current jam?
I briefly alluded to going to an island, once on this island, going to an island this weekend. And I was on a boat, and so I was hitting the yacht rock vibes. This song isn't quite a yacht rock song. I mean, I think
it's adjacent.
It's
in a rock, dinghy next to the yacht.
It's yacht rock. It's in a little motorboat, maybe with like a six pack in it. And it was actually on the soundtrack to Fast Times at Ridgemont High. And it is our beloved Jackson Brown singing Somebody's Baby from 1982.
Yeah.
There was a brief moment in the early 80s where, like, kind of straight, heart-throbby men with feathered hair had the opportunity to express their covetousness towards other guys' girlfriends. You can think of Jesse's Girl as one of those songs. But also, you know, this the kind of insecurity beneath it,
I
sort of appreciate. Plus, it's just, you know, it's a good, like, beer drinking boat and song. Mm.
Yeah, as I was telling you, I used to play this at parties and it doesn't fail. It does you right.
Well, the world was more optimistic when we had more keyboards in our songs.
For sure.
Margaret Wappler, is your jam just the sound of a human being not screaming at you?
Right, exactly. A human being sleeping. I finally got to watch Call Me By Your Name. I did a big Oscar cram before the ceremony, and I was so taken with it, which I knew that I would be, but I really love the music. I almost played the psychedelic first song that threads throughout the movie, but then I thought, well, there's already Jackson Brown, 1982, on the list. We'll just keep it a little more modern. Sufjan Stevens, who I thought did a really lovely performance last night during the Oscars in a very fetching Gucci jacket, has a song in the movie at the very, very end called Visions of Gideon. And I think it's beautiful, and it is a bold choice in a sense to end a movie where you're just fixated on one of the characters' faces the entire time, just reading his emotions, and I love that about it. So here's Visions of Gideon. Sufjan, I think, is such a beautiful, genuine songwriter. It just gives me chills.
I'll forever associate that song with Hanukkah now, too.
Right, who wants latkes?
Oh. I love that Alonzo Duralde's tweet about how about that T-shirt that said, "You owe me 48 states."
I know, right? I feel that way. I'm like, at least give me California.
And I wonder if he was. I was wondering how much he was channeling. You know, Elliott Smith's really soft performance that year, 1997, the year he was up against Celine Dion's
Yes. Yeah, there is definitely a similarity where, like, I'm just going to be the soft guy in the room. Nothing wrong with that.
I mean, after Gael Garcia Bernal and Sufjan Stevens performed, I did want the rest of the songs to be performed by other Natalie Portman exes. Andy Samberg, a swimmer from Harvard.
And just throw in that ballerina guy she's married to, too.
Chris.
Okay, so I went highbrow with my Oscar documentary short for the beginning of the show. So I'm going to do something more fun. On this week's RuPaul's Drag Race, the main challenge was to create a Spice Girls-like group called the Kitty Girls. And in it, Bibi Zahara-Benet, the winner of the first season, who's back for All Stars, stole the show with her rap portion for her character Jungle Kitty. And it's become like a gay meme, and I can't get this rap out of my head. Yeah, I'm pussy bitch. Ooh la 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 la, see boom. Doko chocolata. You can take my snatch, drag it up, wheel it up, give me more, bring it to the ball. It's nonsense.
Yes.
It's wild, but in a week where, like, RuPaul really stepped in it with some not woke trans things and not understanding that trans women can do drag, cis women can do drag.
Yeah.
Realizing that, like, drag is about an energy and a fun. Like, so many of the other people in this episode tried to, like, my character's a math nerd and all the jokes are about this. I'm an emo person. She just, like, comes out with full nonsense and energy and joy, and it won over the whole episode.
I love Bibi being on the show so much this season because she won the first season, and she came from, her approach to everything was always non-traditional. Like, she was always just, like, weird, kind of. And her proving her skill set over and over again, that even though she's not giving you your first thought or your third thought, it always works, is pretty great.
And now I'm going to enter every room this week saying, yeah, I'm pussy, bitch.
I love the slivers of, like, gay patois that find their way into the rap, like, the Simone, and also the mocha latte part. Yeah. It's just like the tinier parts of those larger phrases.
Yes.
All forged together in a beautiful bit.
I am also going very gay. And yes, I'm throwing two musicals at you in the same week. I'm sorry. I've been away for a long and I had a lot. I had a backlog. A new musical just opened on the West End. It's called Everybody's Talking About Jamie. It is based on a documentary like about a real life 16-year-old who like was having hell in his family and hell at his school. And the only thing he wanted was to grow up and become a drag queen. So Dan Gillespie Sells, a British pop star, was like, I'm going to make a musical about it, even though I don't know anything about musicals. And it's really good and poptastic. Let's listen to some of it. Is it a little Evan Hansen-y? Yes. Like, do we need another work celebrating the emotional journey of an attractive, white, gay young person? Maybe not. But the second song is a song called Wall in My Head that is sort of, it's always nice when you see things, aspects of the gay experience that haven't been expressed in, like, media or art. You see it for the first time and you're like, oh God, why did no one ever write a song about that? And it's less fun and it's more just conventionally musically, but I still liked it. So that cast album is out now. There's also a really good concept album that Dan Gillespie Sells did to sort of like sell the musical. And it was just nominated for a Lambda Literary Award. All right. I had one drink like 2 hours ago, and I felt completely incapable the whole time I was here.
It's day drinking.
Day drinking will do that to you.
Also, before we go into the official end, I do want to say, while I was in D.C. Doing stand-up comedy, there were a lot of people who came with a lot of love for Pop Rocket. A guy named Keaton said that he was Margaret Wappler.
Oh, wow.
A girl named Claire came for her birthday and screamed out Karen Tongson during the middle of the show.
Hi, Claire.
Tell Keaton I want my credit card number back.
There was a guy named Hal who kept insisting I needed to go with him and his husband to a strip club so a straight guy could wag his dick in my face. And I did not go because I was tired.
So they know us well.
I've been regretting it ever since. It was fucking great. You have been listening to Pop Rock, hosted by me, Guy Brandon, with not Winter Mitchell, she's somewhere else, Margaret Wappler and Karen Tongson, but also Chris Schleicher. Chris, where can they learn more about you?
On Twitter, I'm at CSchleicherOn, or just search Chris Schleicher. I'm the best one. And this week, I write for Champions. It's premiering on NBC Thursday at 9:30 after Will and Grace.
It's a really funny show. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Meza. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to everyone who leaves us 5-star reviews in iTunes. Ms. Kiva writes, this podcast led me to other great podcasts, Forever 35, Las Culturistas, and more good music than I can list here. Elizabeth Reichman writes, Elizabeth Reichman 81, I'm sorry. Absolutely my favorite podcast of the week. Keeps a boring mom like me connected to the world of pop culture, media, and academia. Love it. Krugs 303 said, love the hosts and their substitutes as well. Came here because of Dave and Alonzo's recommendation. Stayed for the humor and entertainment. Stinkinor says, I love this podcast. Lovely and diverse group of smart people talking about pop culture. Stinkinor is a good competitor for the pop chart for best name. If you haven't already, please review us. It keeps Margaret healthy. Get in touch with us on Pop Rocket. We are at Pop Rocket. Or join our Facebook group and get in the discussion. We're a production of MaximumFun.org. And our senior producer is Laura Swisher.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.
I'm going to enter every room this week saying, yeah, I'm pussy, bitch.